League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hey, next on the Teen Nation, thanks for coming back and tuning in to part two of this week's show featuring my conversations with Darren Pang and Kurt Bevacqua. As you guys know, Darren was a goalie for the Chicago Blackhawks, now a member of the Blackhawks broadcasting team. He also does a fantastic job every 4 years when we get to the Winter Olympics. Nobody is a better blue line, red line analyst than Darren Pang is. He's also an ambassador for Amura Golf. So you'll hear about all of those things. We get into the Blackhawks draft. We'll talk a little bit about his time with Mura Golf. We'll go back in time. He went over to Royal Troon in 97 for the Open when Justin Leonard won, then went back a few years later to play that course in 2005. He also went over and played Carnoustie, which is the site of this week's Senior Open. We'll talk about all of that plus a whole lot more when Darren joins me here in just a few minutes. Like I say, following him is Kurt Bevacqua. Kurt played in the major leagues from 1971 to 1985. He played for the Royals, Pirates, Brewers, Rangers, and Padres. Would have been probably a World Series MVP had the Padres won it in 1984. Kurt batted .412 with two home runs in that series. We'll also talk about the time he got to meet his boyhood idol, Mickey Mantle, and his time in Pittsburgh playing for Danny Murtaugh. And he came back after he was there in 74, came back several years later. So he played for Murtaugh and then Chuck Tanner a little bit later on in his career. We'll hear about all of that and more when he joins me about 30 minutes from now. So sit back, relax, let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next hour or so. Before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants.
Every January, PGA Tour Superstore pros meet every manufacturer, learn about the latest equipment, log thousands of hours of training, and together hit over 100,000 balls, all so they can get you the perfect fit.
Now back at Next on the Tee with me is former Chicago Blackhawks goalie and now a member of the Blackhawks broadcast team, and that's Darren Pang. Let me remind you a little bit about Panger's background. He grew up in Nepean, Ontario. Played youth hockey for the Nepean Raiders alongside Red Wings Hall of Famer Steve Yzerman and a guy who's another great friend of this show, Dan Quinn. Darren was the first goalie drafted by the expansion Bellevue Bulls of the Ontario Hockey League. In 1984, he helped the Ontario 67s win the OHL's Memorial Cup, and he was named top goalie and to the All-Star team. He was signed as a free agent by the Blackhawks later on that season. Got called up by the Blackhawks late in the season in 84 and was there full-time in 87. Got his first win that year in October against the Winnipeg Jets. He set a Blackhawks goalie record with 6 assists that season. He played in the league until 1990. Following his playing days, Darren was a member of the broadcast team for the St. Louis Blues, along with doing a number of games for the NHL Network and Sportsnet. And like I say, now he's back with the Blackhawks. He will forever live in the hearts of hockey fans around the world for the great job that he does all the time with the Winter Olympics. And I couldn't be more honored. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Panger, how are you, my friend?
Chris, I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing tonight?
I'm fantastic as well, thank you. I want to catch up with you back in Chicago this past season. What was it like going back there?
That was incredible. In fact, I posed with your great on the balcony of my high rise there in the West Loop. I posed with your great hockey sweater that you sent me, which
I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, that next on the tee. That's a wonderful job too, by the way. That anybody would be proud to wear that sweater, and I certainly was. And it worked out great. You know, I think when we talked before, it's you spend a lot of time in certain cities, and St. Louis is so dear to my heart. And I was a Blackhawk goalie that ended up being a broadcaster for St. Louis and never played for the Blues. So for them to welcome me in and treat me like they did was incredibly special, and I'll be forever indebted. But then to have a phone call from Rocky Wirtz and his son Danny Wirtz and Jamie Faulkner of the Blackhawks and say, "Hey, would you come to Chicago and maybe your career goes full circle?" It was a real pleasure going back to Chicago and being in the unbelievable city, great restaurants and bars, and that whole West Loop and that River North area. I just was like, wow, this is really something else. We had a blast. And as far as broadcasting is concerned, there's nothing like getting ready for a game at the United Center. If you've never been there and you've never heard the national anthem and you've never heard the vibrancy of that building, you got to go, because it's a wish list. It's a must make a visit kind of place. So that was unbelievable. And then, you know, now I'm entering season two. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm entering season, jeepers, what is it? 4 with TNT. So to combine the two is incredibly special. And you get to see the best in the NHL on the national games. And then you get to travel with one of the greatest organizations in all of sports in the Blackhawks. So really, really fun, Chris. Thanks for asking.
The Blackhawks have struggled the last few seasons, yeah, but they had 3 picks in the first round in the draft this year. What'd you think about the players they selected?
Well, I tell you what, Artie the Party was a big pick at number 2. A big right-handed defenseman that came overseas, played in the USHL, played at Michigan State, and won all kinds of accolades there. So I think the one thing that the Blackhawks have done, like most of the teams, Chris, that have kind of emptied the tank and traded players or left legacies to this, not to the side, but, you know, like, Jonathan Toews is a great player. He's a Hall of Fame player. Patrick Kane, the same thing. Duncan Keith. These guys were integral parts of winning 3 Stanley Cups in almost a 7-year period. And then you got to say goodbye to those guys, and then you got to welcome in other guys. So in order to do that, you get assets, you get draft picks, you hopefully get prospects. And now here I am as a broadcaster, kind of in the beginning of that. And I saw last year what Connor Bedard meant to the NHL and to the Chicago Blackhawks, and the young kids that wear number 98 Bedard sweaters, and the impact that he has on the community, but also in the entire NHL. Like, he's quickly become an ambassador to the NHL, which isn't easy to do when you're 18. So that, and then, you know, I think Kyle Davidson, this young GM, I've really enjoyed being around him. He listens to people. He talks to people like they're just regular people. Like, he's really respectful guy. And they went into the draft, they knew they needed a right-handed defenseman because their cupboard's full of left-handers, good prospects, and bang, he nails Labushkin right off the hop at number 2 overall. He tried to swing a deal to get maybe the number 4 overall pick, which could have been Demidov, that ended up going to Montreal. So he's a guy that really thinks outside the box and just knows that he's got a lot of really good players in the prospect pool. Whether they work out, you don't know, huh, Chris? Like, you never know. I mean, you could watch a junior golfer that's 15 and go, that guy's going to be the next best thing. But maybe he peters out at 19 because he runs out of gas or motivation. You never know, or an injury. So you never know what you're going to get. But I think they've got such a really big pool of prospects that you're going to hit some home runs here. And that's going to be a big bonus for the Blackhawks and their fans too, because their fans last year were incredible. They sold out every night, and it was really a remarkable year of backing up the program and what Kyle's doing as a manager, to say to everybody, hey, we're transparent, we're building, and it's going to take some time, so I have some patience. And I thought the fans were outstanding.
It was an amazing Stanley Cup Finals this year, Panger, between Edmonton and Florida. It looked like it was going to be a sweep by the Panthers after they won the first 3 games, and that quickly changed. It looked like they might blow a 3-game-to-none lead, and then we had a heck of a game 7. What'd you think of the finals?
Oh man, I'm with you all the way. I'm at my lake place in Michigan, and I got this little it's a 4x10 garage door that opens up kind of my Panger's pub right here. And I got a bunch of buddies, including Joey Koser, that played obviously three Stanley Cups, one with the Rangers in 94, two as a player, three as a player, maybe with the Red Wings, and one as a coach. So, I mean, this guy, anyway, to say, long story short, another buddy of mine, Wayne Presley, I played with him in Chicago. He's on my little lake in Michigan, and we all pop around. I got a Celebrity Greens came up, and they put a putting green, so it's facing the lake. So guys wheel up in their pontoon boats. They putt a little bit, and we watch the Stanley Cup final because ESPN had the rights this year. TNT, we were there last year for the final, but we'll get it next year. So I got to enjoy it like a fan. I got to sit back here and watch it with my buddies and have a couple of cold brews and just, you know, talk hockey. So when it was 3-0, I'm like, there's no way that you can beat the Edmonton Oilers 4 straight. There's no way. Like, it's going to go 5 or 6. And I told the boys it was going to go 7 after it went 5. And I said, there's no way that Florida can lose three games in a row. So they're like, you're incredible. You're like, there's no way. There's no, but it's true. Like, at this time of the year, to beat a team 4 straight games is almost impossible. I mean, the goalie's going to have a hiccup. You're going to get a bad bounce. You're going to give up a power play goal. The greatest players on the other team, Connor McDavid and Dreis, they're going to come out to play. Like, I thought it was fantastic drama. And I think we needed that because, you know, the Florida Panthers are a team last year that went to the final, and it wasn't a great, compelling final, you know, series. And then to go back again at it this year and be so dominant, I just didn't think they were going to lose, to be quite honest with you. I told many friends, I said, I watched them. I did many playoff games for TNT with the Florida Panthers. I said, they're just built to win a whole bunch of Stanley Cups, and they might win 3 in the next 5 years. I wouldn't be surprised by that. Just the way they're built, just the way they play, their mentality, they're real pros. They're hard to play against. So I became great fans of the Florida Panthers, certainly in the last 2 years.
All right, switching gears a little bit, we got to talk some golf. And you were at Royal Troon in 1997 when Justin Leonard won that Open. Then you played the course in 2005. Mm-hmm. Talk about your experiences there at Royal Troon.
Yeah, that's great that you follow me on Twitter, Chris, because I posted that. And it's funny, when I got Celebrity Greens to come out and do my the putting green here, I added the first hole in 1997. I managed to get from the greenskeeper the ceramic first hole tee marker. Okay, so I traveled with that tee marker everywhere I've gone, and I've had synthetic putting greens in almost all my homes, and I've always had it there by the green or by a tee marker. And it's there again. And it just reminded me again how cool that was, that I was sitting on the first tee with Steve Yzerman, Alan Trammell, the great Detroit Tiger, Bob Moran, his family's well known here in Michigan, Art Moran, Pontiac, and Buick dealerships. And we surprised Steve with his, I think it might have been his 40th birthday or his 1,000th game. I'm not sure. I think it was his 1,000th game. And we were going to take a trip to Scotland. And he said, I can't do that. I told you that I'd only go there after we won the Stanley Cup. Well, sure enough, we did this presentation to Steve in February. And in June 6th or June 7th, they won their first Stanley Cup. So that was the coolest thing, that we had this gift for him already and surprised him with it. And he was so worried about going to Scotland because he said, I'm not going until I win a Stanley Cup. And then they won the Stanley Cup in 97. So we were able to go there, and we were sitting there on the first tee in 1997 because the stanchions were up. We arrived on Sunday morning. We decided to drive to Troon just to take a look around. We had planned. We played Carnoustie. We played the old course. We played Kings Barnes. We played, where else did we play? Maybe Western Gales and North Berwick. But we said, we got to pop by here and just see what's going on at Royal Troon. And when we did so, and we were able to kind of stand up there and just take a look around, we were in awe. And so for Justin Leonard to win that year was something else. And we never got to play it that year, as you mentioned. But in 05, we went back again. And that might have been Steve's 40th birthday. And we went back again with Steve and six other guys to make eight guys. And my goodness, we just loved it. I mean, standing on that first tee at Troon after we were there in 97, and we were able to look down that fairway and hit a golf ball and play number eight, play the postage stamp, and come back home and play 16, 17, and 18. It was just remarkable. Just great memories for me, because I've been down to Scotland and I've been to Ireland many times, but those are a real fresh, great memories, because those are the first time.
What was it like trying to hit a ball onto the postage stamp?
It was funny. Steve said that to me the other day. We were watching the Open, and he said, I can't believe you got up and down from there. And I go, yeah, I can't believe it either. I hit one right in the bunker, and I was sideways, and I plopped it, and I got it up and down. And I was like, do you guys believe I just got that up and down from the postage stamp? So, yeah, that was pretty cool, fresh memory. And after watching the guys, now they're a lot bigger. Like I'm 5'5" or 5'4" and a half. So my little legs crept in there pretty nicely at the at the coffin bunker, Chris. And I was able to kind of finagle and get in a kind of an athletic stance. But I've seen some of the guys at the Open a week ago, and I'm watching their big legs, and these guys are 6'4" and 6'5", trying to get their legs in there and get their feet. My feet are size sixes. Theirs is probably size 12s and 13s. And I'm like, well, no wonder I could get that ball up and down, because I'm so small. But it was really cool. Hitting that shot from above was really something else. It didn't look as small from above as it did when you got closer to it, if that makes any sense. Yeah. You know, it seemed like an easier shot from above until you got down there. And then the next day we played it again, and I didn't hit it in the coffin bunker. And I was on the right, I believe, and I did chip it up, and I think I got it up and down, but it was a much easier play. But I remember thinking to myself, can you imagine when the pressure's on and you're trying to win an Open and you're trying to get it up and down from this place? Oh my God. Well, unbelievable. Just great.
You mentioned Carnoustie. We've got the Senior Open going on this week at Carnoustie. Tell us about playing there.
Can't wait to see that. I can't wait to see it. And I left my, your baggage tag, after 9 and 10, there's that, you've got the little hot dog stand or whatever, the halfway house is right there. Have you ever played there, Chris?
I have not.
Oh my goodness. It's so cool. And everybody, they put their little bag tags from their club up there, and it's full of bag tags. And I remember seeing Scotty Hamilton's, who I happen to be a friend of, the great legendary figure skater. And we look quite alike, and we worked two Olympics together, in 98 in Nagano, for CBS. We worked together, but obviously he's on the figure skating, I'm on the hockey, and then in 02 in Salt Lake City. So I got to know him real well, and we played some golf together. So when I saw that his name tag was on there, I went over to my bag and I grabbed my bag and my bag tag from my club. I think it was Aurora Country Club that I was a member at in Chicago. And I plunked it right beside Scotty Hamilton's. And I remember thinking to myself, that course, and the history of the course, especially when you get to is 5 or 6, the par 5 that Hogan went 4 under for 4 days. He hit a fade over the cow pasture out of bounds and cut it through the two bunkers, and everybody else tried to go to the right. And I remember just studying the books and listening to the knowledge and the history of Ben Hogan going through that and thinking, this guy birdied this hole 4 straight days. Amazing. So anyway, I really enjoy that course because I play a lower ball and I can draw the ball. So I play it low, and I can kind of maybe manipulate it underneath the wind a little bit. So I really enjoyed that golf course, and it was miserable conditions, but I thought it was just a great treat.
Hanger, for those who haven't been with us the previous times you've been a part of the show, you're a Mura Golf Ambassador. Remind us what's in your bag.
Right now my buddies, Bill Holowaty and my boys at Mura, thanks for asking that, because I've been a brand ambassador since 2007 with them. Never used any other irons other than Mura's. And right now I've got a really good combination going on of 501s. And I've also got my old 301s, and I've got a forged blade as well. So I kind of tinker them all. I've got the original forged blade, and I've got the MB 101s. And so when I'm on, Chris, if I feel like my scoring irons, like, let's go wedge through, I guess 7. For me, it'd probably be 8. I'm not a great, I'm not a great 5-iron player and 4-iron player. At all. So I kind of, if I get into an area, I want my blades smaller on the scoring blade. So that's what I kind of tinker with right now. I just got, they're brand new wedges that are out right now. And I just put them in the bag. I just literally played 9 holes before our weather in Michigan got so bad. I had to leave the course. And so I just am in love with the fact that they're hand forged and the family history and that they were sword makers and they put such pride into their irons. So, I feel very fortunate, Chris, that I'm able to play those irons and show them off. Cause all my buddies are like, okay, how do I get those? And I go, here's what you do, you know, and here's how we can get a hold of them. And so I feel very fortunate. It's a very easy process to go through it. And especially now, Chris, too, because the cost of irons, you know, if people get afraid of it, but most guys, you go wedge 9, 8, 7, 6, probably 5, right? So you're really only you got 6 irons that you're paying for, really. I mean, and somebody that's a really good player that really hits a 4 or 3 iron, God bless them, because I got a 9, I got a 9 wood and a 7 wood in my bag from TaylorMade because Gretzky passed them to me. Was it last year in the final? We were playing a Grove 23. And he goes, you got to hit this 9 wood. Dustin hit it in the 22 US Open, Dustin Johnson. I go, Dustin Johnson hit a 9 wood? He goes, yep, like 242 in the air and landed on a dime. And I'm like, give it to me. I'll try it. And so anyway, I ordered that up. So I hardly even hit a 5 iron anymore. So I'm very happy about that. I feel way more confident because I'm a terrible long iron player. So that solved all my problems right there.
Panga, just a couple more before I let you go. And you've mentioned the back 9 greens a couple of times. I saw the video. It's rolling a 12 and a half in the backyard. Yes. Boy, that looks like a fantastic setup you've got out there.
Really, really, really great. Weston Weber over at Celebrity Greens, he was at Southwest Greens for a long time. And he sold that. And he had, a non-compete for several years or a few years. And he did my green out in Arizona. And so I was like, I got to get him back here. So luckily he flew here last year and he brought a couple of guys from South Carolina and he basically put on a clinic, honestly, a university clinic that I watched firsthand that my buddy Jason Kronk that started Michigan Turf now that's a partner with Celebrity Greens in Michigan. And I watched him go through it and teach these guys. And I love it. I get the 60-pound water roller. I roll it probably twice every morning. I got the stimp meter. So if I'm playing a tournament, like next week, I got the club championship. If the greens are rolling 13 or 12 and a half, I'll go out there on this, on my Celebrity Greens. I'll roll it. I'll make sure they're perfect and I'll put the stimp meter on there and I'll see if they're 12 and a half or 13. So that's been a real pleasure. I can chip and putt and just dick around is what, you know, what I do. And it's so much fun. And all the boys come over and we have little competitions and the guys love it because they're like, I can't believe how fast this green is. I'm like, yeah, I've got it really fast right now. I got it summer. It's hot right now. It's summer hot. But thanks for mentioning that because I like to post some stuff because I think a lot of people, Chris, don't understand. Like if you're going to make the commitment to something like synthetic greens, and there's so many great companies, but I would say that Celebrity Greens is right up there. That's why Rom uses it and Max Homa and Marco Mir has been a spokesperson for them for so many years. It's because you can get it to your specifications of whatever club you play. And that's what I love about it. It just rolls so pure.
One more before I let you go. And your son Tyler has been a golf pro and your nephew Jake is another great player. Give us an update on the things that they're doing.
Yeah, my nephew is part of the lower part of the Canadian tour right now. He went to Utah State, played 4 years there. I actually got a chance because now that the U.S. Junior Am is going on, right, it's 30 minutes away from me. It's obviously at Oakland Hills. Many people talking about Charlie Woods playing in it, and I play that course so many times. It's so beautiful. But I got to caddy for Jake in Tennessee at the honors course several years ago when he qualified. So I was his caddy and he's a terrific player. So he's trying to, you know, he's trying to grind it out. He's trying to make a buck. He's learning what it's like to, you know, to work at and really work at it and know the value of a dollar and making a cut. So he's doing wonderful. My son, Tyler, He was at Raritan Valley in New Jersey for several years, and Glen Echo Country Club in St. Louis as an assistant pro. He has finally given that up. He's got three young daughters, and the hours were just too much for him. So he's taken a step back, and he's done several things in the past couple of years, including teaching. So, but he's great. He's going to be here in Michigan at the Lake House. I'm going to have five granddaughters here in a week. In a week. And they're all under the age of 4 and a half. So grandpa's going to be worn out. We're going to be on the boat. We're going to be on the tubes, and they'll be putting in the backyard. So Chris, thanks for asking. And you're always such a gentleman to ask those questions, because it does mean a lot to talk about family. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hanger, before I let you go, remind our listeners again how they can stay up to date with all the great things you're out there doing, whether it's following you on social media or it's online.
Well, yeah, I'm at Panger40 on X. Darren R. Pang on Instagram. I don't post a lot on Instagram. I do watch a lot on Instagram, but more on the X, because that's more of my hockey feed and stuff that I get more of my stuff information wise when I wake up in the morning and catch up on hockey stuff and what's trending and golf stuff as well. And Catherine Tappan and I have a podcast as well called Back to You, which kind of a classic, as you know, you're a sideline reporter, and you know, let's go back to you upstairs, back to you. So, Catherine and I have had a great time. She's an unbelievable reporter in person and full of integrity. And so we started that last year and having some fun with it. And so we'll continue that on when the hockey season starts again.
That's fantastic. Hanger, it's always a huge thrill knowing you're going to be a part of the show. It's something that I look forward to every summer when you've got some time. I can't thank you for spending it with me again tonight. You're fantastic, my friend. I hope we get this privilege again soon.
That is my pleasure. My pleasure all the way. We'll talk during the hockey season. Let's catch up and we'll talk a little hockey as well.
Look forward to that. Hanger, all the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Sounds great, Chris. Take care. Thanks, buddy.
You too.
Bye.
That is a great Darren Pang, folks. Again, you can follow him on social media at Panger40 on X, Darren R. Pang on Instagram. Back to You is the name of the podcast. He's just a wonderful guy. I mean, you hear it in his voice and everything that he does, whether it's his podcast or when he's broadcasting a Blackhawks game or when we get that wonderful time with him during the Winter Olympics. I can't thank him enough for everything that he has meant to me and wearing the sweater and all that sort of thing. Panger is a wonderful person. He means a great deal to me in this show, and I look forward to catching up with him a little bit later on during the hockey season. Coming up next is former major leaguer and one of our favorites from over on the Thursday night tailgate show side, Kurt Bevacqua. Before I bring Kurt into the show, let's talk about our friends over at Squares Golf. And folks, do you sway and you're off balance in your golf swing? You know what? It could be your shoes. A golf shoe needs structure to provide stability and reduce sway. How can you tell if your shoes lack structure and are hurting your game? If you can hold your shoes by the toe and heel and twist it, toss it. Squares was designed for the perfect balance of structure and comfort. Isn't it time you tried Squares? Try the new Speedbolt at squares.com. That's squairz.com.
Frustrated with your golf game? Imagine playing with total confidence. Join me, LPGA Pro and golf mindset expert Debbie O'Connell, for my Conquer Your Golf Mind Challenge. Bill cuts six strokes and Lori is club champion. What's your goal? Click the link or text NEXT to 727-339-0106. Use code NEXT for $20 off. Your tee time for transformation is now. Will you take the shot?
All right, now back with me is former Major League infielder Kurt Bevacqua. Let me remind you a little bit about Kurt's background. He's from Miami Beach, Florida. He played his college ball at Miami-Dade College. He was originally drafted by the Mets in the 32nd round in 1966, and the Braves in the 6th round of the January 1967 draft. Didn't sign with either of them. He did sign with the Cincinnati Reds, who selected him in the 12th round of the secondary phase of the June 1967 draft. He was traded to the Cleveland Indians in 1971 and made his major league debut that June. He earned the nickname Dirty Kurt for regularly having the dirtiest uniform on the team. He played in the major leagues from 1971 to 1985 for the Indians, Royals, Pirates, Brewers, Rangers, and Padres. He will live forever in the hearts of Padres fans for his amazing performance during the 1984 World Series when he hit 412 and hit two home runs. And I couldn't be more honored that I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Kurt, how are you, my friend?
Chris, how are you?
I'm fantastic. You, how are you, Kurt?
I'm doing great and much better after I'm so glad that I came on and got to hear Darren talk for the last 10, 15 minutes or so. Wow. He's a tough act to follow.
He's a great guy. There's no question.
He is. Wow. What a storyteller. And isn't it great to have a memory and be able to remember things? He remembers everything.
Yes, indeed. Speaking of memories, Kurt, when I was going back and looking at some more of the stories about you and your life, I read that Mickey Mantle was your boyhood idol. He retired after the 1968 season, which was when you were starting in A-ball. But I read that you got to have a picture with the two of you on the top step of the dugout at Arlington Stadium. What was it like getting to meet your childhood idol?
Well, it was special. I was growing up in Miami Beach, Florida, and, you know, back in those days, there were really only two teams that anybody in that area got to see. And it was most of the time the two teams that played in the World Series every year, which was the Yankees and the Dodgers. So even though I loved the Brooklyn Dodger hat, when they moved to LA, I hated that. And I wasn't very old, but I still remembered it. And I became a full-fledged Yankee fan. I continued to love Duke Snider and Gil Hodges, but Mickey Mantle became my all-time favorite. You know, I really have a fondness for all the older Yankees from that time. You know, I'm talking about Tom Tresh and Tony Kubek and Bill Scourin and Cleet Boyer and Yogi Berra, naturally, Elston Howard. You know, I could name all the guys and I could name their uniform numbers. And it was fun being a baseball fan in those days. And the picture that you're talking about was taken at an old timers game at Ranger Stadium in Texas. And Mickey was there. And I asked him for a picture. And the best part about it was what came out of that was I got invited to play in Mickey's golf tournament in Joplin, Missouri, which I took part in for a couple of years. And I was actually playing a practice round with a guy that I brought from San Diego and on the golf course. And we were over close to a house. And all of a sudden I hear, "Hey, Kurt, I'm sure glad you made it." And I look up and Mickey Mantle's standing on his porch.
Wow.
And he proceeded to invite Bill Owen and I, who was a friend of mine, into his house. And Bill Owen embarrassed the hell out of me that day because unbeknownst to me, he had stuffed about a half a dozen baseballs in his golf bag. And he was going to get guys to sign them during the functions. Well, he broke out the whole half dozen baseballs while we were in Mickey's house, and Mickey gracefully signed all of them.
Wow.
For Bill. And that was a special memory also, that Mickey, for one thing, that he remembered who the hell I was. And the fact that I got invited to his golf tournament. I still have the shirt that was given to us. You know, when you play in a golf tournament, you get a little swag bag. In his swag bag was a shirt with the logo on it, the Mickey Mantle Celebrity Invitational. And I actually still have that shirt. Wow. To this day. And that was a few years ago. But yeah, that was special. I mean, getting to meet your childhood idol naturally is a special thing, but getting to know them beyond that really makes it special.
People always worry about when you meet your childhood hero that they won't measure up to what you had in mind or what you thought they would be like. But it seems like for you, Mickey really did.
He really did. Probably because in my mind, he could do no wrong. and really neither could any of the rest of the Yankees. Even though, you know, I saw them at times when they were a little tipsy, and Hank Bauer would play in Mickey's golf tournament, and he would sit at one hole of par three, and each team that rolled up there, he would be the extra putter that that particular team would have for that hole. And right beside him was a bottle of Jack. And that's the way Hank rolled. And it was fun times. I don't know how those guys did it, but they did.
You mentioned a minute ago that you loved the Brooklyn Dodgers hat, but you hated it when they moved to L.A. It seems like that might have been the beginning of a lifelong hatred of the Dodgers.
Yeah, and then Tommy Lasorda didn't do anything to make it better. So it was, I got to not like the Dodger. You know, they've got a wonderful organization, but I became pretty adamant against not liking the Dodgers when I got into their division, when I got traded to San Diego Padres. And it made it real easy not to like them, especially when we started to put the distance between the Dodgers and the rest of the teams in the National League West, even though San Francisco was always there and always a good opponent for the Dodgers. You know, the rest of the teams in that division always had a problem with them. But, you know, we started playing some good ball in the early 80s, and that's really when things started to ramp up with the different things that we throw back and forth at one another. But, you know, we had fun. I had fun with it. I think Tommy took it personally. But, you know, when he said that I couldn't hit water if I fell out of a boat, I thought that was one of the funniest things I had ever heard. not only because I knew better than that, but it was funny. I mean, that's a funny line. And, you know, I've always threatened, especially when Tommy was still alive, to make a video, in full uniform, standing on a boat and just falling back into the water and making a big splash, and then coming up in the video and saying, I hit the water. but it never got done. And then after Tommy passed away, it was wasn't as much fun.
Curtis, you know, I'm from Pittsburgh, and this show is available on the Pittsburgh Tribune review site. And my favorite time, of course, of your career was when you were with the Pirates at the beginning of the 1974 season, and when you came back in 80 and 81. Talk about your time in Pittsburgh over those years.
Well, those are really mixed feelings, and I'll tell you why. The only negative part of that whole experience in Pittsburgh was the way I played baseball and the playing time that I was afforded. The people, the team, the city itself, the way their fans there, it couldn't have been more wonderful. And I went away to this day with guys that were on that team that were the most wonderful teammates that I ever had. And I'm talking in particular about Willie Stargell, Dave Parker, Doc Ellis, Richie Zisk. They were great guys, and they were good guys to have on your team. I mean, back in those days, people didn't want to mess with the Pirates. You know, they not only wielded big bats, but they were some pretty large men. And I mean, there was a famous game in 1974 that Doc Ellis started. And he drilled every single Cincinnati Red that came to the plate. And
really?
That, yeah. And if you you started with mentioning that the year that I was with the Pirates in 74, that was my first year with the Pirates. And I went back there in 80 and also 81. I spent the strike year there, which was miserable. And but going back to 74, I was in the outfield, and that was the first day I met Ritzy Zisk. And we were in the outfield, and we were just shagging balls during batting practice. And one of Danny Murtaugh's favorite saying was, "Wheel the bats, boys." I mean, he cared about nothing but his hitters swinging the bat. He would devote 90% of all of our practice time to hitters and hitting. And the pitchers were in the outfield, and they were running from line to line. Our coaches, Bob Skinner, and the other coaches that we had would be hitting fungos to the pitchers. Once they got the center field, then they'd hit them a fungo where they really had to sprint 40, 50, 60 feet to be able to catch the fungo ball that was hit. And then they'd continue to the next line, which was the left field line if they started right. And then they'd walk back, and then they'd do it all over again. That day, my first day in camp with the Pirates, I'm shagging in the outfield with Ritzy Zisk, and we're talking and developing a friendship. And here's Doc Ellis in curlers, and he's doing his running with the pitchers. I saw him run by us. He catches the ball. He makes it to the line in left field, and he turns around and walks back, and he takes a little bit of a detour in order to walk by Ritzy Zisk and I. And he says, "The first time I face the Reds this year, I won't get out of the first inning."
Wow.
That was it. And Ritzy and I just shook our heads. We didn't have any idea what he was talking about. And he never mentioned it again. Never talked about it.
And
except
then went out and
as
did
he
it.
Was as he was walking away, "I won't get out of the first inning, and I'll bet you Chateaubriand on that." And that was it. And then he kept walking. So we broke camp. Remember, that's the first day of spring training. So we got 30 days of spring training. Then we break camp. We went to St. Louis. And then we came back home and faced the Reds. And Doc started the game. And I wasn't playing, like a lot of time that I spent in Pittsburgh. And here he starts. First hitter, Rose, nails him. The second hitter was Joe Morgan, nails him. Or it might have been Dreesen. And he nailed him. And so on and so forth. The only reason I bring this story up is because he hit the first four guys in their lineup before Larry Shepard, the pitching coach, went out there to talk to him. And then Danny Murtaugh followed with taking him out of the game. And not one person from the Reds said anything to anybody about anything until Pete Rose crossed home plate with the first run. And when he was about three quarters of the way to the Reds dugout, he turned around and he hollered something, which was nobody understood what it was. But that was the only player that said anything. The umpires didn't throw anybody out of the game. It was it was a different game back then. But the moral of the story is Doc did that on purpose.
So it's interesting, though, to your point, right? That I mean, you know, that's not something you see every day in baseball. Is you going out there and you're plunking the first four guys? I can't believe the benches didn't clear.
I know. They didn't say anything. So all of a sudden, I'm realizing that I'm around guys that are going to do whatever they want to, because that's the way that bunch was. And especially guys like Doc, and Stargell naturally was a big star. Dave Parker was a rookie. And I mean, I'll never forget seeing him for the first time in spring training in the locker room. I mean, he was an Adonis. mean, 6 foot six, 245 pounds, and didn't have an ounce of body fat on him. And boy, what an athlete. And Muhammad Ali fast, when he's shadow boxed and messed with you in the locker room. He was just, but would give you the shirt off his back. And that was the same way that, that Pops was. And, you know, the coaches back in those days, you know, I mentioned Danny Murtaugh. You know, we had, Bob Skinner and, you know, the old school guys that, boy, I don't even know if I can, if I can pull a parallel out on what managers and coaches were like back then to now. And it's certainly not taking anything away from the guys that are in those positions nowadays, but you know, it was just a different time. And I am so happy, that I had an opportunity to grow up and take part in a major league career during those days.
You've talked to me in the past about, speaking of Willie Stargell, Willie was my idol as a kid. Getting to play alongside of Pops, you did it a couple of different times in both stints in Pittsburgh. But what was the impact that Pops had on you, not just as a ball player, but as a person?
You know, he made me realize that, going back to what I said earlier about my stint in Pittsburgh and the fact that I had mixed feelings about it. When we went on strike in 1981, that was at a time where, you know, it was hard for a guy to not get paid for a month and a half. You know, the salaries that were being made back then, you know, certainly, were much lower than what they are today. You know, I think it would be hard for guys today not to get paid for a month and a half. But you know, back then it was even worse. And when the strike ended, I got called into Chuck Tanner's office and got sent for the minor leagues for 2 weeks. And, I mean, I was beside myself because I think I only had like 43 at bats the entire year. I mean, it was just a miserable year. Chuck was just not, a manager or the kind of ball player that I was. He only cared, about star players. He cared about getting second guess. If Stargell and I were on the bench, I tell you what, if I would have been the manager, I might have done the same thing. But when you got a 500 career batting average against Steve Carlton and you send up a guy that's got 100 career batting average against Steve Carlton, then there's something wrong there. And what's wrong with it is that, you're worried about getting second guessed by the writers. And managers were concerned about that in those days, especially certain managers. And, unfortunately, Chuck was one of those guys. I have the utmost respect for him, when it comes to, the person that he was. He was a great guy. He wasn't a good manager for me. And, when I left Pittsburgh, I was happy. I came back here to San Diego, but when I got sent out, Willie sat me down, and he goes, "You know what you need to do?" He goes, "You need to go and prove these guys wrong." And even though I had been playing professional baseball for quite a few years before then, I really hadn't had anybody say that to me. And I went down there with a chip. I went down to AAA with a chip on my shoulder. And when I came back, I still had it because they recalled me in September. You know, again, I didn't get any playing time, but, at the end of the year, when I asked them to release me, knowing that I had an opportunity to go back to San Diego, I was happy, and I carried that chip on my shoulders when I went to San Diego, in particular when I faced the Pirates, and I did some damage against them from that time on in my career. So that felt pretty good. And when you got a guy that's of the stature and the status of Willie Stargell, and he comes and sits down next to you in the locker room, knowing that you're down and out, and he lends a hand, that's pretty special. And that's the kind of guy Willie was. I remember the day he died, and it was a sad day. It was a sad day for me. Willie was a great guy, and I think everybody that came into contact with him and everybody that knew him feels and felt the same way.
Kurt, I want to go back to September of 1977. You're with the Rangers at the time, playing a home game against the Angels. You hit two home runs off of Baylor Moore. Had to be a huge thrill for you to hit not one, but two home runs in that game.
You know, I was surprised to see that I had multiple home runs against Baylor Moore, because I remember facing him the first time and him just blowing me away. I mean, that guy could throw a baseball through a brick wall. And but, you know, it just goes to show you that when, you know, as you go along the road of professional baseball, if you don't change with the times, then you're going to get left behind. And, you know, I learned real quick that anytime a pitcher got me out, or anytime a smart pitcher gets a hitter out, they're going to continue to pitch you that way until you prove to them that you can't hit it. If you can't hit it, they're going to continue to throw it to you. And so you have to make adjustments. And the quicker you make those adjustments, the better off. You know, most of the time, those adjustments when you're a starting player, there were times in my career where I started quite often. You have to make adjustments each at bat. You know, now it's crazy because you might go to the plate four times, five times in a game nowadays, and face five different pitchers. You know, we didn't have that happen too many times. You know, there were times where we went through a bullpen and got into quite a few pitchers' back pockets. But, you know, very seldom do you go two, three, four games in a row where you're facing four, five, six different pitchers. But nowadays, it's kind of commonplace. But yeah, that was a good night. 77 was an all around unbelievable year for me. You know, I kind of put it all together. You know, starting in winter ball, through the Caribbean series, right in through spring training, through the season, and I ended up hitting 330 that year. And it was a special year, and I was rewarded for it. You know, Brad Corbett, the owner of the Texas Rangers, gave me a 3-year contract for more money than I ever thought I would make in the game of baseball. So being in the right place at the right time, you know, performing and having faith in yourself when you go to the plate, you know, all lended itself to, you know, that outcome. And it also gave me confidence as a pitch hitter later on in my career, when, especially when I started playing in San Diego for Dick Williams. You know, he was a manager that would send me to the plate in any given situation and almost hit me for anybody in the lineup, I think, except for Steve Garvey and, of course, Tony Gwynn. And I'll blame him for that. But it was, you know, it was fun times. And, you know, being able to look back and hitting two home runs in one game at the major league level is pretty special also.
You mentioned Dick Williams. What did it mean to you to have a guy like him in his tenure in the big leagues want you in the lineup at the biggest time of the year? Particularly, you're now the guy who played in the DH position in the 84 World Series, and you came up big.
Well, I got to tell you, Chris, when you look back on it, you have to say, you know, it's not a coincidence. You know, Dick was a winning manager in a lot of towns that he managed. You know, he was a winner in Boston. He was a winner in Oakland. And he was a winner again here in San Diego. He was a successful major league manager that rubbed people the wrong way because he was the way he was. But you know what? He knew the makings of who he had on his bench and in his clubhouse. And he knew who was going to rise to the occasion and who had the intestinal fortitude to be able to do the things that get done in the postseason when it's most important and everything's on the line. You look back at all the teams that he managed, and he just happened to have the right guys in the lineup at the right time. That's not a coincidence. And I'm proud to say that Dick believed in me enough that he saw that in me and he put me in the lineup. Even though I had a not real good 1984 season. And he goes, this job's yours. You know, go out and show everybody what you're made of. And he knew what I was made of. And it was a good feeling. It was a good feeling knowing you got the support of your manager, especially a guy that had been around for a long time. But don't get me wrong. Dick could be bad. He could be nasty. If you got on his wrong side, you were in the doghouse and it was hard to get out. But deep down inside, he was a good guy.
As I recall from our previous conversations, you always loved it when the pressure was on. What was it about the pressure situations that always brought out the best in you?
You know, I don't know what the reason for that was. I think it just goes back. I think it goes back to my earlier years of being really, really cocky. When I used to scream the dumbest stuff that you could possibly imagine at opposing benches and coaches. I mean, I had our coach in junior college tell me to sit down and shut up when I was hollering at the golf coach, college coach, to bring in his ace from the bullpen when he was facing us one day. And Demi Mineri looked down and said, Kurt, will you shut the hell up? We don't want that guy in the game. And sure enough, he brings him in the game, and I'm at the plate, and I hit a home run. Well, Demi I could have never predicted that was going to happen, nor did I expect it to happen, to be perfectly honest with you. But that was the cocky in me. And I think, you know, I think it just carried on. I can tell you for one thing, for sure, that there were times that I went up to the plate at the major league level where I wasn't very sure of myself at all. And I think all major league players go through that. And then there were other times where I went up, or most of the time, especially from 77, 78 on, when I went up to the plate, especially in a key situation, you know, I'm mumbling to myself, you're facing the best hitter in the world right now. And, you know, I didn't say it, but I was thinking it. And I think that helped make me successful as far as when the times got tough and the game was on the line. And the other thing was the experience part. And when I say that, I'm talking about knowing that when you went to the plate, a pitcher wasn't going to get beat on his second or third best pitches. So you knew what his best pitch was. And if you went up there with the game on the line, you were going to get his best pitch. So there was no guessing or even anticipating what the pitcher was going to throw. You knew what he was going to throw if you were smart. Mm-hmm. Because nobody wants to get beat not given your best. And if a pitcher's second and third best pitch are their change up and curveball, and their number one pitch is a fastball, you know, what are you going to do if the game is on the line and you're going to go up and face Nolan Ryan in the ninth inning? I'm sure as hell not going to look for a curveball. He's going to throw you fastball. He's going to throw you what got him there. And that fastball got him there. You know, Sparky Lyle. I don't think he ever threw anything but a slider in a game situation. You know, Bruce Sutter was the same way with a split finger. Trevor Hoffman with the Padres when he came up with that great changeup that he had. You know, why would a hitter even think of looking for a fastball, even in a fastball count, from a guy whose best pitch was something other than a fastball? It just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Or vice versa. And that's what made me successful, because I don't know. I kind of chuckled at myself thinking that I know what these guys are going to throw me. Is, you know, I look back at a couple of at bats and think to myself, I must have been nuts. I mean, one in particular, I told Tim Flannery on the bench that the next time I faced Adley Hanmaker, that I was going to sit on his slider because I know he was going to throw it to me. And I came up with the bases loaded. It was about the seventh inning, and he threw me five consecutive fastballs, and I'm sitting on a slider, and he hadn't thrown one yet. And three of those pitches were balls, and two of them were strikes. And the ones that were balls just missed, a couple of them, from being strikes. What do you think he threw me? Three and two.
Threw you the slider?
Threw that slider. Threw that slider three and two, and I hit a grand slam home run.
Wow. What a great
moment.
So
I wish I could have done that a little more in my career. I wish more of my at-bats would have been in game situations. You know, I saw a post on social media the other day that surprised the hell out of me. The Padre with the most career walk-offs. Who do you think that is?
Is that you?
Well, it was Tony Gwynn.
Okay.
Tony has nine. But who do you think was second?
Must have been you.
Yes, it was. And like I said, it really surprised me. It really did. I mean, if you think about the guys that have been in a Padre uniform and have had that opportunity, you know, I'm right behind Tony with eight. But, you know, I was put in situations where I had the opportunity to do that. You know, you got a guy like Dave Winfield, who spent some years here. Just because Winnie maybe only had five or six doesn't mean he wasn't a good clutch hitter. It just means that, unfortunately, his time in the lineup wasn't there at that particular time.
Right.
So he didn't have the opportunity to get that walk-off hit. And, you know, a lot of times guys that are of that stature, when you come to the plate with the game on the line, you're going to get walked also. You're going to get pitched around. You know, Tony fully admits that that hitting behind Alan Wiggins in 1984 was the best thing that ever happened to him, because all he got was fastballs. Everybody's worried about Alan Wiggins stealing. So where hitters hit in a lineup are very important. The way the manager makes out that lineup card and how he inserts certain guys in certain places in that lineup card is intricate to the outcome of that particular game. And a lot of people just think, oh, you throw a lineup card together and you hear about managers, oh, the team's in a funk. The manager put nine numbers in a hat today and they drew them out and that was the line. Well, sure, you're going to do that every once in a while. But the construction of a major league lineup is so important to the outcome of the game. And if you're a big fan and you dissect those lineups the way I know I have over the years, it's fun to do. And it's fun to sit there and go, I wonder why he put this guy in this position. And then you see something that might happen in the game. And you go, oh, that's why. You know, whether it be taking a pitch with a guy running in a certain situation, or infield shading a player a certain way, but him being able to hit the ball the opposite way that they were shading him in certain situations. It's really interesting when you break it down, and that's why I continue to love the game to this day, even though I think they've made some changes that that shouldn't have been made for stature and political reasons, but it's still a great game. It really is.
Kurt, one more before I let you go, and it's interesting you bring up Alan Wiggins a moment ago. In the 84 season when you were with the Padres, in August of that season, you guys are involved in a big brawl here in Atlanta against the Braves. I live in Atlanta now. Pascual Perez hits Alan Wiggins to lead off that game, and each time Perez comes to the plate, you guys throw at him. Craig Lefferts finally hits him, and then all hell breaks loose. Do you remember that game?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember. And I'll even do a follow-up, a quick follow-up to that story, because we were talking about Dick Williams, and that's what the follow-up will be about. But, Pascual Perez was from the Dominican Republic. God rest his soul. He's passed away. But Dominican pitchers aren't afraid to throw at a hitter. That's just flat out a fact. If Pedro Martinez is standing in front of me right now, I'll say that to his face and he'll laugh because he knows it's true. Joaquin Andujar was the same way. He was a pitcher in the Houston organization, went on to pitch for the St. Louis Cardinals back in the 70s and 80s. Any pitcher that came from that island just had it in him to have no problems hitting a hitter. Well, Alan had gotten three hits the night before this brawl day that you're talking about. And two of them were of the bunting variety, which you don't see anymore. But Wiggy got two bunt base hits, and then he got a single to go 3-for-4 the night before, and we beat the Braves. And then the first pitch of the game on this particular Sunday was right at Alan Wiggins, and it hit him. Well, the rest of the day was devoted to hitting Pascual Perez. You know, at first, we were going to hit Jerry Royster, who was the Braves' leadoff hitter and left fielder that day. And as soon as I heard that, I said, no, because Eddie Lee Whitson was our starting pitcher and Terry Kennedy was the catcher. I said, what are you going to hit Royster for? I go, he's standing out in left field. He has no idea what's going through that crazy ass's head right now. And he had nothing to do with this. This is all on Pascual Perez. So just wait for him to come to the plate. Well, three innings later, everybody complete, because Royster expected to get drilled. The first pitch of the game from Eddie Lee Whitson was a called strike, and Jerry Royster is literally walking out of the batter's box, stepping away because he was expecting to get hit. Well, when Pascual Perez came to the plate, he wasn't expecting to get thrown at because he thought, they just forgot about it. He might have hit him, but he didn't hit him on purpose. And what's Eddie Lee do? He missed him. I mean, he threw a ball right behind him, but he missed him. And that's when it kind of started. Both benches emptied. Both sides were warned that the next hitter that was thrown at, both the manager and the pitcher, were going to be ejected. Well, when Dick went back to the bench from going out and talking to the umpires and arguing with the umpires after the field cleared, there were no punches thrown or anything like that. Champ Summers and I kind of chased Pascual around a little bit, but he had his bat in his hand and he got himself up against the screen right behind home plate, and it made it impossible to kind of to get to him. So with all of that said, the umpires got everybody back to their dugouts. They warned the managers. Dick came back to the bench, and he's talking about getting the bullpen up. So we got guys up in the bullpen. Now, this is the third inning. The Braves haven't scored yet. And they're getting guys up in the bullpen already. And Dick goes, Jack, you'll be the next manager. And then Harry, and then Ozzie. And he's going down the names of all of our coaches on who's going to be the manager after that particular guy gets kicked out of the game. And he goes over the order of pitching. So to make a long story short, every single time Pascual Perez came to the plate that day, he got thrown at. The pitcher was ejected. The next pitcher didn't throw at him because of obvious reasons. We would have never been able to finish the game. But each time that he came to the plate, the first pitch was thrown at him. And the coach or manager got ejected. The pitcher got ejected. And we didn't hit him until the eighth inning when Craig Leffers came into the game. And he hit him in the back on the first pitch. And that's kind of really when all hell broke loose. There were some skirmishes leading up to that one, but that was the big one. But the follow-up on the story that I wanted to tell you was that was in August. In September, the Braves came to San Diego. Everybody thought that was going to be a retaliatory game because Pascual Perez was pitching. You know what Dick Williams did? He put everybody in the game, in the lineup that night against Pascual, that he knew that if they got thrown at, that they were going to go directly to the mound to get him. Champ Summers was in the game that night. I was in the game that night. Boach was in the game that night. You know, guys that didn't necessarily start, we were all in the game. And Pascual Perez, for the first time in his life that night, I don't think threw a ball from the middle of the plate in on any hitter. He was scared to death that he might hit somebody. And he knew if he did, that it probably wasn't going to fare well for him. But there again, going to what Dick used to do as a manager, he knew, I mean, he wasn't looking for trouble when he made that lineup card out. He knew that he had to have those guys in the lineup that he knew were not only going to protect themselves, but also protect their teammates. Not that the other guys wouldn't do it, but it was just Dick's way of doing things Dick's way. I can't say it any other way. I mean, it was, that's why I looked up to him so much. And I'm so glad that he got into the Hall of Fame.
Kurt, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can we stay up to date with you now, whether it's online or it's on social media?
Well, I'm on Instagram and Twitter and or X and also Facebook, and it's pretty simple, at Kurt Bavacqua. So I stopped doing the podcast because I took over as executive director of the Major League Baseball Retired Players Association. So we're trying to do good for retired players and keep up on what's going on with our pension plan and things of that nature and player benefits, retired players benefits. So it's a full-time job, and I'm enjoying everything that I'm doing right now. And I appreciate you asking about that.
Well, Kurt, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show. It's always fun when you're a part of this segment. I always learn a lot, always hear a lot of great stories. You're one of my favorites, my friend.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate that, and continued success on your show. And I'll come on anytime.
I appreciate that very much. Take care, Kurt. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you. Bye now.
See you, Kurt. That is the great Kurt Bavacqua, folks. Again, you can follow him on Twitter at Kurt Bavacqua. And Kurt had a wonderful, long career in the major league. So many great stories, so many great teams that he was a part of, great teammates that he had. Obviously, I am really partial to his time in Pittsburgh. I hate that he didn't like it and didn't get the playing time that he probably earned and deserved. But he came through in the clutch. And that's one of the things that I love so much about Kurt, is when the pressure was on, it really rose him up to another level. I mean, two home runs, batted over 400 in the 1984 World Series. The Padres, unfortunately, lost to the Tigers that year. But if they had gone on to win game 6 and 7, probably a World Series MVP. So he always came ready to play. And there's a reason why they called him Dirty Kurt. And it wasn't because he played dirty. It's because he always got his uniform dirty. That guy was sliding. He was doing whatever he needed to do in order to try to win a game. He played the game right. He played the game hard. And that's what I respect so much about him. And then so many great stories over the years. And as you guys know, Willie Stargell was my hero growing up. And he always speaks so highly of Willie. That's one of the things that I love each and every time he comes on, to kind of get him to talk a little bit about the relationship that he had with Willie and what Willie not only meant to Kurt as a ball player, but just as a person. So I thank him for that, and we'll look forward to catching up with him again soon. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this week's edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks again to Ian Baker Finch, John Inman, Darren Pang, and Kurt Bavacqua for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are, well, of course, Tom Patsy will be back. We'll kick off a new century worth of shows that he'll be a part of. Our good friend John Cook is going to be here. Always great when Cookie's a part of the show. Looking forward to getting a lot more great stories from John. Wisconsin Hall of Famer, Wisconsin Golf Hall of Famer, Gary D'Amato will be back. And then we're going to round things out with getting an update on the great things they're doing there at Blue Tees Golf from their co-founder, Drew Kohler. So a lot of great stuff to look forward to next week. I hope you'll come back and be a part of the show with us. Want to thank my friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for hosting this show on their site. You can go online to triblive.com and then click on the sports section tab, and you're going to find the most recent episode front and center for you right there on the homepage of the sports section. If you click on sports and then go to podcast, and then you're going to see the Next on the Tee logo come up, click on that, and then every episode from this season is going to be available for you right there. You can also find this show on great places like Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, and Player.fm. And like I do every week, my sincere thanks to the good folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But as always, most of all, my sincere thanks go out to the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts, and that is all of you. I appreciate you all so very much. Until next week, hit them straight, my friends.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.